This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
And I'm very, very honored at this point to welcome the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and distinguished academic, Amy Ellis-Nutt. Amy's a science and health writer at the Washington Post, newly moved to D.C., see where my mind is, not New York. In 2011, she won the Pulitzer Prize in feature writing while working at the Star-Ledger in Newark, New Jersey, and before that was a reporter at Sports Illustrated for 9 years. Graduate of Smith College and has master's degrees in philosophy from MIT and journalism from Columbia, and has taught at Columbia and Princeton and Harvard, and now is on the staff at the Post, residing here with us. A previous book in 2014, Shadows Bright as Glass, An Accidental Artist and the Scientific Search for the Soul, based on an article in the Star-Ledger that was a Pulitzer finalist about a man who had a stroke and found that he expressed himself through art. A haunting and poetically rendered tale of a scrambled mind and the neurological roots of creativity. And is co-author also with Frances Jensen, MD, of the New York Times bestseller, The Teenage Brain. Dr. Jensen was here earlier this year with that book. And finally, this wonderful, extraordinary book, Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Amy Ellis-Nutt.
Whoa. Very short. Thank you. Thank you so much, Rhonda. Thank you, Politics and Prose, for inviting me here. And I had to admit that having moved here 15 months ago, this is my first time here. And so that's very, very bad. But it's also very, very good. So I will be back and can't wait just to wander around. So I always sound much more interesting when someone introduces me. And trust me, I'm not. But I thought I would begin just by reading. I'm not going to read a lot. I just thought I would read, you know, maybe a page from the not going to read the ending of the book. I made that mistake once. Really kind of spoiled it. So I'll read a bit from the prologue, and then I'll give you a little bit of background, and would really then just love to open it up to questions. So this is from the prologue. We are all born with traits, characteristics, and physical markers that allow others to identify us, to say, he's a boy or she's a girl. None of us, however, is born with a sense of self. By the age of 2, children recognize themselves in a mirror, but so do chimpanzees and dolphins. Even the humble roundworm can distinguish its body from the rest of its environment via a single neuron. But of our who-ness, or whatness, our essence, there is no single place in the brain, no clump of gray matter, no nexus of electrical activity we can point to and say, aha, here it is. Here is myself. Here is my soul. All those questions about who and what we are, they were still in the future when Kelly and Wayne first brought their boys home from the hospital. The parents looked on their identical twin sons as wholly unexpected gifts. Unable to have biological children, they felt they were living their own version of the American dream, courtesy of 2 perfect little specimens of male Homo sapiens. Wayne in particular yearned for the day when he could buy his boys their first hunting rifles, their first fishing rods, their first baseball gloves. That was the way it had always been done in his family, and he would continue the tradition. Who we are is inseparable not only from who we think we are, but from who others think we are. We are touched and loved. We are appreciated or dismissed, praised or scorned, comforted or wounded. But above all else, I'm sorry, but before all else, we are seen. We are identified by others through the contours and colors and movements of our bodies. In his 1903 treatise, The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois, the African-American author and intellectual, wrote about a double consciousness, a two-ness of the Negro race. Quote, the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity, unquote. He believed the history of African Americans in the United States was the history of a kind of, quote, strife, this longing to attain self-conscious manhood, to merge his double self into a better and truer self. He simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and an American without being cursed and spit upon by his fellows, unquote. Dignity, self-respect, the right to be treated as an equal, that's what everyone wants. But Du Bois knew that those who are alienated from the community of man because of color, or one might add, because of sexual orientation or gender, have a much harder path, because the alienated, the differentiated, the misfits of society must bear the burden of a single unspoken question on the lips of even the most polite members of society. What does it feel like to be a problem? For Nicole Maines, an identical twin born, an identical twin boy, it was never a problem. Gender was never a problem. She knew exactly who she was. What's probably more remarkable even than that was that her mother allowed her to figure that out and to be who she was. So if the story is anything, it's more than just about, you know, one girl, one teenager who discovers who she is, who knows who she is, and has to convince the rest of the world of that. But it's about a mother who allowed her to be able to figure that out and allowed her to sort of live that from a very early age. The biggest transformation in this book is probably with the father, Wayne, who was fairly typical, male, middle class, conservative, Republican, grew up in upstate New York, small town, hunter, loved obviously fishing and hunting, and it was harder for him. And it was harder for him because he had expectations. He had a model of what it meant. That was different for Kelly. This was a mother who grew up in her own, in the Midwest, in a dysfunctional family where she was given up for adoption by her mother and adopted by her aunt, who left home at an early age and experienced life as a teenager, you know, out west when most of us are still in the middle of high school. Kelly had no expectations, and I believe that that's a fundamental part of how she was able to be the best mother she could for this child, because she had no expectations of what she wanted her twins to be. And because of that, I think this story is unusual in many respects, but I think especially to the extent that this was a child who also grew up confident that everything would work out. There were hard times. There was a legal case where she was discriminated against and harassed as a fifth grader and not allowed to use the restroom of her choice, the girls' room. But she faced all that knowing who she was without having gone through the secrecy, the lies, the covering up, the terrible angst that so many children carry over into their adult years, people who are transgender. So there's a lot about this book that I think is unusual insofar as what we read today and understand about the path of transgender people. At the same time, I'd like to say that this is a story about a very ordinary family, just in a very extraordinary situation. But these are people that you'd be hard-pressed not to identify with. I think that what's most remarkable about them at this point in their lives is also their now willingness to share their story. This was something that the Boston Globe gets credit the executive editor of the Washington Post, Marty Baron, was at the time the executive editor of the Boston Globe, when they did really one of the very first stories, page one, takeouts about a transgender child, when they profiled the Maines' family in December of 2011. At that point, they were got a lot of press calls and a lot of emails asking for them to do more media. And they didn't want to do any of that. It was like a one-off for them. They wanted to get the story out there, but then Kelly and Wayne wanted to raise their kids in quiet and as normally as possible. I was sort of brought in, this kind of landed in my lap, to write a book that wouldn't come out until they had graduated from high school, which they did this past June. And so it gave me as a writer the luxury of getting to know the family and being around them and watching these two kids grow up at a very seminal time in their lives, and sort of inoculated from the rest of the world and the media and what was going on. So as a writer, it was a gift that this family gave me in being able to tell their story. They're extraordinary people, all four of them, all very different. It's been a privilege and a gift to be able to tell their story. So I'd like to open it up. You know, I don't know how many of you have read the book or seen any of the interviews or what, but I'm going to guess that you have a lot of questions, and I would love to sort of get that discussion going.
I was at the Gender Conference East, a two-day conference about trans and for trans families last month, and I was interested as to how you arrived at your 25%, I guess, DCIS statistic, because at the conference what I noted was there was quite a range as to, you know, whether medical person said 80%. If you don't identify between until the ages of 7 to 10, but a much better chance of not desisting, I guess, if you identified between the ages of 2 to 4. And then I go into a different room, and somebody's outraged by that statistic. And so I was wondering, you know, as you researched and came up with data, how you came up with your 25%.
And I just want to clarify, you're talking about the percentage of children who express different gender identities, you know, with either toys or clothing or the things that they say, than the gender that they were born into. And the percentage of those who then go on to be transgender.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not surprised that that is fluid. I've even heard slight differences. I say 25%. Some people say 20%. There are two things I should say about that. Chiefly, that comes from Norman Spack, who is the endocrinologist and the creator of the first transgender clinic for children in the United States in 2007 in Boston, was also Nicole's doctor. As someone who has probably, at least in this country, spent the most amount of time both researching and being involved with transgender children, I think he has sort of one of the best qualifications for that. That being said, these are statistics that are impossible to pin down at this point. Mm-hmm. For one very big reason, that we just don't know how many transgender people there are in the United States. And there are many different ways of breaking down that statistic. People who have the surgery, people who don't, people who identify but never tell anyone. There are no clear statistics. The best statistics cite 700,000 or 800,000 people are transgender in the United States, and those are based on three state surveys done in, I think, 2005 and 2009 in the states of Massachusetts and Connecticut. So it's a pretty poor, you know, sample base. And, you know, frankly, what we know now is that, you know, we're just seeing and hearing from children or from parents of children saying, this is what my child is telling me. And so we're just at the beginning of really trying to understand that. I do think it's important that people know that just because a child may you know, a female child may, you know, play with boys, typically boys' toys, you know, or vice versa, that doesn't mean, oh, my God, they're going to be transgender, or that clearly means transgender, because it just doesn't. What we are understanding is that gender identity, sexual orientation, and gender anatomy are three different processes that happen largely because of brain development and can happen at, and they happen at different times, likely at different times in utero. And so we're learning that there are all sorts of different combinations and expressions, both of gender, sexual orientation, and obviously gender anatomy. So that was a very long answer to say, basically, we don't know a lot.
Well, you know, if I can ask just a follow-up on that, at the conference they were talking about, you know, parents having to make the difficult decision of having their children go on puberty blockers and, you know, how long a period of time you can be safely on puberty blockers, and then they get to the ripe old age of 15 or 16, and then they're old enough to make the decision. And so, the question becomes, in terms of informed consent, is, right. Well, you know, in the Nicole case, it seemed very easy because she was 3 years old saying she hated her penis. But when you get somebody who identifies maybe at 7 or 10 or whatever, then I think it's a harder decision to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. It was a much clearer case. This was a kid. There was just no doubt about this kid. And this was right from the age of 2, before the child could, you know, can barely put, you know, full sentences together. I do think that, you know, because of that great variability, that's primarily the reason why we have things like now we have programs with puberty suppressants. We don't know how long we can go because we're just starting to do it. The first clinic, as I said, in the United States was opened in 2007. The Netherlands has been doing it a lot longer. So we don't know. What Dr. Spack has says is that he believes, and from his experience, that you know, if a child decides, you know, to go off puberty suppressants, then immediately goes into puberty of the gender anatomy that they were born into. The whole reason for puberty suppressants is so that the child has time to decide, to figure out, to go through many different, not just psychological tests, but also gets to experience transitioning, you know, clothing-wise, pronoun-wise, relationship-wise, to take as much time as possible in order to really know, yes, this was what was meant to be. So puberty suppression is all about making sure that this is a child who's on the right track. Now, I can say of the 170 or some odd people when I initially spoke to Dr. Spack, you know, a few years ago, of children that who had gone through his clinic or were in his clinic, of 170, only one child had decided to stop the puberty suppressants. And honestly, he said he believed that that had a lot to do with the parents not being ready for it. And that, you know, I think that's kind of a remarkable statistic. We don't hear a lot from people who say, you know, and this is all still sort of a young science, too. So we have kids who are just now, you know, reaching young adulthood saying, yeah, no, that was really a mistake. We haven't heard that, but you're right. It's all still very new.
My question is about the patch or the suppressant.
Yeah.
How long has that been around, and do we know any of the side effects of it?
It's been around. They've been doing it in the Netherlands, I believe, for at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong about that. Side effect wise, it doesn't appear to have any side effects. You're simply delaying. You're simply, you know, extending essentially childhood. You're simply holding off hormones. But again, I don't think we fully know that because it's something that is just being done, and therefore it's just being studied. So there are clearly many studies that will need to be done to be followed up. And I know that's one of the criticisms of this, but, you know, endocrinologists believe that it's just an artificial way to simply delay something that can be delayed anyway naturally. and that, you know, they're not interfering ultimately with the child going through puberty or going through female puberty if it's a male to female transgender with the added value of hormones. So
hi, thank you for this book.
Sure.
I think it's it has the potential to be very transformative. It reminded me a little bit of Andrew Solomon's book, Far From the Tree, and he had
Thank
that
you.
Fascinating chapter on on transgender. So two questions. One is, you know, you talked about waiting to release the book. Now that it is out, I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the reaction, whether that's whether you've done book tours, whether that sort of differs depending on where you are. I mean, I have to say I have been sort of appalled. There still seems to be an acceptance. People can say, as Mike Huckabee did, some fairly awful things publicly, and it's sort of accepted by some.
Yeah.
So one question there just on the tolerance and acceptance of transgender. And then second, an issue that's really been coming to the fore in my daughter's generation, which is the members of the transgender community that don't identify with one or the other gender. And I have to say, this was pretty new to me, and there was a fascinating article in the Times about a University of Vermont recognizing a neutral gender, and it seems to be happening more and more across the schools, and just and you talk a little bit about the idea of some cultures recognizing that, and if you could talk a little bit more about that as
sure.
well. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. In answer to your first question, I have to say, I mean, I haven't been on like a huge book tour. I've done a lot of, you know, radio and, you know, it's mostly been, you know, New York and then I guess, you know, national radio and things like that. I'm going to be doing more things in the spring with schools, which I'm really looking forward to. But I have to say almost universally, the response has been terrific. And the only negative, oddly enough, the only negative emails that I received were from when the Washington Post, wonderfully, the health section did an excerpt of the book, had a sort of beautiful takeout. Within, I think, about an hour of that being put up online, I got a handful of emails, three or four, no more than that. But really sort of scathing, you know, typical, this is, you know, against nature, against God, and all of that. Aside from that, I've gotten only really wonderful responses. And I have to say, Wayne is doing a lot more media, I think, probably than I am. And if you get a chance to hear him, you know, he's just a wonderful, down-to-earth guy who's is just very compelling to listen to. And he's gotten a lot of responses. And he's already, for the past few years, has been someone who's gone around and talked at conferences and things. So he has sort of a whole group of connections out there. So he's heard from a lot of people that he knows. But I'll give you an example of someone that I heard from a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it's the obviously the beauty of the internet. And this was a man from New Zealand who had read the book, and I'm still not sure why he read the book. I wanted to ask him that. But this was a guy who had his own tech company. I looked him up, and it was true. He had his own tech company in New Zealand, conservative, you know, family, Christian, all of those things. And he said, I had no idea. And he says, this was eye-opening to me. And he says, this was such a compelling story that when he had someone come in to interview for a job, he noticed on the man's resume that it made references to a lot of LGBTQ things. And he said, ordinarily, that would have meant, you know, out of there. And he says, precisely because of that, he hired him. And, you know, when I read that, it was like, you know, I mean, as a writer, you want to think that things make a difference. That was, you know, worth the price of admission right there. And to me, that's been the most satisfying is hearing from people that this really is eye-opening to them, that, you know, these were things they hadn't really thought about or they they'd had the wrong ideas about, and that's been the most gratifying. So I have to say that's been very good. And the second part of your question was?
The gender sort of neutral.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we're going to be dealing with that, you know, for a long time to come. I think, and it was all very new to me. I mean, I'm a writer who loves reporting, and so a lot of this was also eye-opening to me. And, I went to a women's college, to Smith College, and I remember going back a few years ago and sitting in on an LGBT meeting with trans men and thinking, I don't really understand this. And by the end of the hour and a half, I totally got it. Going to a women's college was a safe place for these people to be, and I understood that. And so I had my eyes opened in a number of ways. I think all you have to do is look at what science is telling us every single day. And just last week, there was a fascinating study out of Tel Aviv, I believe, a major study of 1,400 individuals looking at the brains of both males and females, cross-gender and age, young to adult, through adulthood, and looking not just the way studies have been done at looking at single brain structures or looking at white matter versus gray matter and male to female, but looking at the whole brain, looking at brain structure and neurons and all of that. And what you come away with and what the scientists in this study did was, and I love this use of the word, wasn't just a spectrum, but it's a mosaic, that gender is a mosaic. And that if you looked at all of the things that typically we say, so there's a left part of the hippocampus that typically is larger in male, or the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis is twice as large in men as opposed to women, or women have a thicker corpus callosum, both sides of the brain, because we know that because we're so communicating both sides of our brain all the time. Women are a higher species. We can get into that. We can get into that later. And, they looked at all of these brain structures and they looked at, white matter, gray matter, and they discovered that between 0 and 8% were 100% male or 100% female, that everybody else fell in between. And when they looked at behaviors associated with these people, they found that only 8% clearly had complete identification behaviors of one gender as opposed to the other. And I think that science is going to just keep confirming that, we are a spectrum. And when you think about the possibility of variation, and you begin with looking at, what are there, like 37.2 trillion cells in the human body, three quarters of which have chromosomes, right? And there are 46 chromosomes in each of those three quarters of those cells. And there are hundreds to thousands of genes that are attached to each of those chromosomes. And those molecules that switch those genes on or off are what we can attribute almost everything in how we act, feel, think, and behave today. Very, very, very small percentage of it is chiefly just, the genes that we inherit. Everything that we breathe, that we eat, that we stress out over causes molecular switches in utero and even after in utero, which would be when we're alive, when we're born. I call that post-utero. It's a very fancy scientific talk. All of those things affect our makeup. And so when you think of the possibility for variety, it's nearly infinite. So it should really come... it came as a surprise to me, but it really shouldn't. When it comes right down to it, we really shouldn't be surprised. So I'm sorry, there's another long answer.
Hi, yeah. Thanks. So you spoke earlier about the parents and their backgrounds. I also found Nicole's brother to be an interesting person, not only because of what he went through and experienced with the court case and the move and how that affected him, but also just how intuitively he understood and accepted that Nicole was his sister, not his brother.
Yeah.
And that is a theme that comes up elsewhere in the book. The one part that I remember was the anecdote with the story where they went to Boston with a family with two kids the same age who understood that Nicole was a girl, even though at that point she still had a boy's name, she was presenting as a boy, had boy's anatomy. So I'm just wondering if you would speak a little bit both about Nicole and Jonas's relationship and also that broader piece about children.
Thanks for bringing up Jonas, who I just love. I mean, I love all of them, but I have a special soft spot for Jonas because it has not been an easy life for him. As he says in the book, always being the brother of the transgender, you know, sister is not easy. One of the most compelling things that he ever said to me a few years ago, which is in the book, was, you know, imagine what it's like, you know, he's much more approachable than Nicole. Nicole is very assertive and was as a kid growing up, you know, knew exactly what she wanted, and if you got in her way, you know, she was going to let you know about it. Jonas was more of a softie. So people would come up to him if they were trying to figure out, you know, what's with Wyatt, who dresses like a girl and looks like a girl. And they would come up to Jonas. And what Jonas said to me was, you know, imagine what it's like, you know, when all you have is a sixth grader's vocabulary. Now, and he said this to me a couple of years ago when he was like 15 or 16. Yeah. That's like an incredibly wise, self-aware thing to say. But it's so true. And so on the one hand, you know, he didn't have the language to express, you know, what was going on. On the other hand, he would say to me, but Nicole is just Nicole. That's just, you know, she was always interested in the things she was interested in, and I was interested in the things I was interested in. So it made sense to him that, you know, Wyatt wanted to be called Nicole, and because that's just who she was to him. You know, and I think it speaks to the difference between society and nature and obviously language and the words we use to describe ourselves, that so many children seem to be so comfortable with there being ambiguity or there being, you know, fluidity. Nature favors diversity. It's society that favors conformity. And I think that, you know, it's listening to our children in a lot of ways, because their understanding is both more basic you know, more inherently right, if that's the right word to use, I'm not sure. Yeah, oh, yeah.
The famous Boston Clinic you cited, and certainly this is a very new field. I wanted to ask you more locally about some of the clinics that have been launched, particularly at Children's Hospital. You may know of some others. And I want to ask you, based on the experience of the family in the book and from what you've known and researched, when you enter that program phase, and you mentioned the parent also who seemed to reverse the process, once it entered that phase. What's different in terms of what the parents can expect once you are on the cusp of, you know, that scheduled transformation?
That's a great question. As far as the other clinics, certainly I think the one in Boston is the largest. I know that there are... I can't remember if it's the Cleveland Clinic. It's usually academic hospitals that have the clinics attached to them. More often, it's the case that there are now endocrinologists and doctors locally who are treating children and becoming specialists in it. And again, a lot of this, I say, is comes to us from the Netherlands, which has really sort of been spearheaded all of this. So I'm sorry that I can't give you anything more specific about that. Johns Hopkins is way behind the times, but that's a whole other discussion that we can have. And now I've forgotten the second part of your question.
Your parents' expectations.
Yeah. You know, I think if you asked both Wayne and Kelly, you know, they didn't know. And there was a lot that, you know, Nicole was basically the first American patient that Dr. Spack treated. So there was an awful lot that was unknown both to them, both to the doctors and the staff, as well as to Kelly and Nicole. The unusual situation of having identical twins was that, you know, they could watch Jonas going through, naturally going through puberty, and that was, you know, he was sort of the guinea pig for when they knew was about the right time, you know, to begin the hormone treatments for Nicole. I think one thing that they realized was that their maturity levels differed greatly. In some ways, Jonas, obviously, because he was taking a natural in time progression into puberty, was maturing at a faster rate. So things like socially, he was also breaking away more from Nicole, and he was more interested in girls. It's a whole other discussion we can have about Jonas, who's gotten in trouble in college with that. But, you know, whereas Nicole, the difficulty there was Nicole was still sort of childlike, was still very much attached to Jonas, was having more difficult time having relationships. So I think a lot of their issues were because they had identical twins who now all of a sudden were at very different places growing up. And I think it was especially difficult for each kid in a different way. Nicole, because she still was sort of attached to Jonas, and so many of their friends were in common, but now Jonas was looking at some of Nicole's friends in a different way because he was going through puberty. And I think that was a lot of the difficulty that they had to deal with.
I have a question about vocabulary and genderqueer. You know, when Jonas said he didn't have the vocabulary to discuss or describe what Nicole was going through, I think part of the failure to understand for most people, I know it took me about 6 months to get it, I finally went to this conference 2 weeks ago and I got it, was that if you start talking about male and female on a spectrum, then you're admitting the binary as your construct. And when you start with that construct, it gets completely confusing. And so the facilitator of the group said, well, don't think about it as binary, think about it as a circle. And I know you talked about it as a mosaic, but how do you identify somebody on a form? You're not going to say circular gender or individual gender, but non-binary is very non-descriptive.
I kind of like circular gender. That appeals to my sense of paradox. But, you know, language is it's always tough when, you know, basic civil rights things are changing the world. It's even more difficult, I think, in this regard because of the limitations of language and because, you know, we have to think of new words. And so, which is why we're now thinking of new pronouns, you know, for people. As someone who is cisgender, which I had to understand, was meant that I'm identify with the gender of the anatomy that I was born into, there was a whole lot to learn. And look, I think at some point, so for instance, one of the criticisms that I have heard from some people, especially from transgender people, a few, about the book was that I refer to Wyatt and use the male pronoun early in the book. Because a lot of transgender people believe that you are who your gender identity is. But here's the thing. First of all, I asked Nicole and I asked the family, I'm writing this book, tell me, you know, how can I identify you? How can we talk about you? How do we negotiate these terms? And, you know, she agreed with me that it's a book about discovery, not for her, but for other people. And so for that reason, including hopefully the many readers that would be out there, it was important to identify and be clear. She was born into a boy's anatomy, even though she identified as a girl. So let's use the male pronouns and the male noun to the point where she then changes herself legally to Nicole. And, you know, that was something I asked of her and asked about, and we talked about. It wasn't something I just decided on my own. So I think that's really important. But that's a difficult thing to negotiate when you're talking about people. There's a tendency in the press to say so-and-so who used to be known as Bruce, and that's a real no-no. And I understand that. But in writing a book where we're trying to help not just transgender people, but everyone else to understand what it means, then I think it's important to clarify, you know, what the terms mean. But I understand that it's delicate and that the language is also going to be changing. You know, I remember sitting at a reunion back at Smith like 5, 6, 7 years ago and sitting around talking to freshmen, and I was asking this little, I mean, she looked about 13, you know, what groups that, you know, things that she belonged to. And she had just started a new society. And I said, oh, what is it? And it's the Asexual Society. And I'm like, okay, all right. I hadn't thought of that one, but why the heck not? So, you know, it's a brave new world in the best sort of way.
Thank you very much for the talk so far.
Sure.
The question I have has to do with you. As you got to know Nicole and her idea about being a female, did it change your idea about what it means to be female or woman?
Yeah, it really, you know, it really kind of blew my mind. Look, you know, I grew up in this, you know, really came of age in the 70s, feminism, you know, went to a women's college. And I can tell you, when I was a freshman in college, fall of 1973, the big event that year and was when Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes. And we marched around campus. I mean, you think today it just seems like so quaint and naive. You know, yay! And that was a huge thing. I mean, 30, you know, fast forward nearly 40 years later, where we're at, more than 40 years later, oh no. And, you know, it's a sea change. I mean, it's a remarkable where we've come to. But yes, I'm probably someone who embraced the idea of gender being a spectrum as an intellectual concept without really thinking what it meant. Now I really, really understand that it's deeply Darwinian, you know, that Darwin would make sense of this. There's more variety out there, that this isn't an aberration, that this is variation. And I think that was a critical thing that I learned. And look, I'm also someone who, you know, this is fancy for me, as my editors and friends will attest. This is dressed up. So, you know, my notions, and I remember growing up as a tomboy and my mother being, you know, very worried about me, and she didn't want me to wear jeans with the fly in the front, only with the fly, only with the zipper on the side. Remember when they used to make, you know, sort of. And I remember the very first story I ever wrote was in like 1992 for Sports Illustrated, and it was a first person story about growing up loving to play baseball. And part of that was my deep sense of embarrassment and even shame when my older siblings' friends or my parents' friends would come over and I would be watching baseball. For some reason, and why, I was also a very slow child in many ways and an odd child, but for some reason that was deeply embarrassing that I was a girl and I was watching baseball, and what would they think of me? So, you know, I don't know where I came up with those, you know, ideas and why I would, you know, take that and that sense of shame, but it was real. And, you know, I can only imagine, you know, I mean, God help me, if I'd been transgender, the kind of torture, you know, that can be for kids, especially when they can't express it. But, you know, to the extent that we're shaped even invisibly by, you know, what our parents say or what we read about or what our older sisters do, you know, all of that was shattered by what I learned, not just from this family, but from what nature and science is sort of teaching us.
Hi. You've been talking a lot. I mean, the whole sense of this is about acceptance, but I'm curious about the comment you made about Hopkins. So could you talk just briefly about...
Yeah.
I take it that that's not on this trajectory.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do mention in the book, certainly, Dr. John Money. And again, when I was taking my Psychology of Sex Roles course as a senior in college, Dr. John Money was it. He was the bee's knees. Where did I grow up in the 20s? I apologize for that. But it was true. Dr. John Money was a behaviorist, worked in gender. He was the doctor responsible really for David Reamer, the famous case of the young boy as an infant who had a surgical operation that his penis was essentially burned off, and so Money decided, look, gender is a matter of how we're raised, instructed the parents to raise the child as a girl, and it was absolutely disastrous. And not till he was, I think, a preteen did he realize, you know, what did his parents tell him, what had happened. And it's a terrible course of events that ultimately ended in this poor man committing suicide. But since then, the gender, you know, there was a lot of problems because Dr. Money promoted this as being a success when it was clearly not. And it took another doctor and a reporter to uncover the fact that it was an absolute abject failure. But beyond that, I'm afraid that Hopkins really dismantled its gender clinics and has really not moved beyond it, and I think in large part because of certain conservative influences still at Hopkins that are absolutely against, the idea of there being transgender being a legitimate, concept or entity. And I think it's going to take a new generation for that to change there, and it needs to.
I think we'll have time for one more question, please.
Thank you. I really appreciate your talk. I learned a lot. I don't think I'm as knowledgeable as many people here. I heard your talk on Fresh Air. It was really interesting. My question was, there seems to be the social aspect, political aspect, and there's a science aspect. And I work in Medicare policy reimbursement. And today Medicare released for public comment, a coverage, potential coverage for, I guess, the gender reassignment. I apologize if that's not the correct term. And this would be for adults since it's Medicare. And so I guess typically Medicare only covers things that have high evidence when they're looking at new interventions and technology. So I was wondering if you could comment on kind of the science, and it seems like on a social political level we've come to a turning point in things, and a kind of where the science is relative to kind of where we are as a society.
Yeah, thank you. It's really occurring, I think, in tandem. The science is by no means settled, but I think our advances in brain imaging, for one thing, has really enabled us to really have insights that were unthinkable, 5-10 years ago. Social programs are catching up, and they're doing it fast. Just in the course of writing this book, insurance programs have now subscribed to transgender policies and are paying for it. I think it was really important that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, like they did in 1973 when they got rid of homosexuality, changed gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria. And what was important about that was making the distinction that it's not a medical problem and it's not a psychological problem with the child or with the person who identifies with a different gender. It's outside. It's the world making it difficult for that person. It's the lack of acceptance and the lack of understanding that causes the anxiety, the dysphoria, the sense of not belonging. And I think that was, the DSM has comes under a lot of criticism, and the American Psychiatric Association certainly. But I think that was really important. And insofar as certainly insurance coding and depends on that, that it was an important, a really fundamental, watershed moment.
And what year was the DSM?
That would have been only a few years ago. Thank you. One of my editors in the back is saying 2 years ago. Thank you. Thank you.
It's clear there's hours more of interest here, and I'm sorry we have to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This is great. Great questions.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.